supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Stress in America is rampant. Certainly no surprise there. And its ill effects are problematic for adults and children. That's what this year's Stress in America survey finds. The results of an online survey of more than 2,000 participants were recently released by the American Psychological Association. Most adults said their jobs, or lack thereof, were the greatest source of stress. And while in the past it may have been easier to hide financial worries from the kids, now more families agonize over thinning wallets. Well, regrettably, what we're finding is many of us cope with stress through eating or sedentary activities or risky behaviors, which only makes stress that much worse. When asked about this, some point to a lack of willpower to make positive change in their lives. Well, that said, there are some terrific tools out there to cope with stress, and we'll be talking about some of them today. We've got three guests on today's show. David Palmiter is a professor of psychology at Marywood University in Scranton. He helped develop the APA Stress in America survey, and he joins us by phone. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. Glad to be here.
I'm also joined by Marlene Schwartz. She's also a clinical psychologist, deputy director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University, and she joins us from Yale. Marlene, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And later on in the show, we'll hear from Dr. Michael Boehm. He's a physician and director of University of Pennsylvania's Program for Mindfulness. Well, if you want to join the conversation, call us. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Please call early in the show. I have a feeling a lot of people have a lot to say and ask about stress. David, let's start with you, and let's get right into the findings. The APA does this survey every year, and the first thing I noticed was that 25% of the people surveyed reported having extremely high levels of stress. How is that defined, and what are the implications?
Well, that's a great question, because, you know, if you say you're very stressed out and I say I'm very stressed out, is that the same human experience? No way to know, really, but we can give people a scale from 1 to 10, with 10 being a great deal of stress and 1 being little or no stress, and ask them where they fall. So 25% of people said that they fall at an 8 or higher.
I wonder if that corresponds to some physiologic measures on stress. I know you didn't have the resources to do that, to measure cortisol levels and so on and so forth. I want to talk about the other 25%. How many people in that population, the other 75%, how many people in that population said that they experienced what they consider unhealthy levels of stress?
Well, about half of people believe their stress is unhealthy is one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is to ask folks, well, what do you consider to be an adaptive level of stress? And at that 10-point scale I mentioned earlier, the average was 3.7. 75% of the respondents are above that level.
So, have there been any studies about the small minority that's below that level, the ones who report having minor stress or none at all? Who are they? Do we know anything about them?
Well, some, a I mean, from this survey, we don't, and where the data are lacking, opinion prevails. And I'll share that I think probably a portion of those people are just individuals who may be disinclined to report personal pain or just don't want to be aware of it within themselves. There likely is that percentage who are genuinely happy, you know, who are joyful and self-actualized, and their stress is mostly a motivator for them. And there are some things that the literature is beginning to say about those kinds of people. It brings to mind Tolstoy's famous quote, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unique in its own way." And I think that's probably true of individuals, too. So the lowest group, most likely, just extrapolating from what's there, they're probably getting a good night's sleep. They're probably engaged in physical activity, a reasonable diet. Their relationships are rewarding and sound. And in their vocational life, they have a sense of meaning and purpose, whether that vocational life is at home or otherwise.
And we know about set points, too, for happiness.
Yes. About half of it seems to be based in our just the temperament we're born with. Only about, it surprises a lot of people, and only about 10% is due to circumstances. It's that other 40% that's intentional behavior. And then I think when you look at health habits and you look at interpersonal connections and then finding meaning in how one exerts one's energy, those are some of the key things that seem to define that remaining 40%.
Well, you know, the essence of stress is not so much, you know, what the world we are living in is doing. The essence of stress is what we are doing with the world that is impacting us.
Exactly. I mean, I deal a lot with kids and teens in my practice. And a common example, I know you see this all the time too, is when a teen commits suicide. Often the adults who are in pain about this will examine the circumstances of that teen's life. Hey, he's head of the football team, she's popular, going to Yale, whatever. But as you just said, it's not so much what happens to us, but it's what we make of it. It's how we think about it, what we interpret about it.
So let's talk about stress in young people versus adults. First of all, who's more stressed? Is that a fair question?
Well, I think I'm a parent, too. I have 3.0 children myself, and you know, our kids make us nuts. We love them so much. It really makes us insane some of the time. So that's a burning question.
I saw a bumper sticker that said mental illness is inherited. You get it from your kids?
Well, I often write and talk about parent phenomenology, and I don't say parent. I'm referring to myself here. It's parent-lunatic. Because we love our kids so much, it really breaks us. It breaks our psychology sometimes. It's too much for us to bear. In the Stress in America survey, for instance, parents are given a long list of things, what matters in terms of your kid's life, and then ask, what's unimportant? Nothing was unimportant.
Yeah.
Everything mattered extreme amount. And so the question you ask about who's more stressed, kids or adults, I think is something that we parents wonder about, and we underestimate our kids.
Well, what does the survey show?
The survey says that, well, at least parents estimate that about 7% of kids are estimated by their parents to be at a significant level of stress, whereas 20% of kids worry a great deal or a lot. Kids, when you look at who worries none or a little, it adds up to 51%, whereas 25% of adults put their stress at that lowest third, 1, 2, or 3. So it does seem, two things seem true. I mean, as best as you can compare adult self-reports and a kid's self-reports, adults do seem to be reporting higher levels of stress. However, adults way underestimate the amount of stress that kids are experiencing.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, through my very informal research, that's not what I have found. You know, whenever I talk to a group of parents, I ask by show of hands how many people experience unhealthy stress. And I usually get the majority of them, but when I ask kids, high school kids, and even middle school kids, how many of them experience stress? I can't find a hand that didn't go up. Almost every hand goes up. And a lot of kids, when I ask them why, a lot of them say that their major source of stress is worrying about their parents.
Yes. Yes, that actually is another thing that the survey inquired about. Asked parents you know, are your kids aware of your stress and how does it impact on them? And then we ask kids the same questions. And 69% of parents indicated that their personal stress has no more than a slight impact on their kids. But 91% of youth indicate that they know when their parents stress because of their increased yelling, arguing, and complaining. And a quarter to a half of these kids feel sad, worried, or frustrated secondary to their parents' stress.
So that
you don't, only 14% of kids said their stress, their parents' stress doesn't bother them.
So that what you're saying is despite all our love, our anxiety, our worry about our children, we're pretty clueless about what goes on inside of them.
I think it's because of that.
Because of
this parental lunacy, we can't bear the thought that our kid is hurting.
Yeah, and you know, parental lunacy or stress or anxiety interferes with hearing. It interferes with vision.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Metaphorically and literally, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I want to bring Marlene Schwartz into the conversation. Marlene, we're going to talk later with Dr. Boehm about what stress does to our bodies. But the survey says a lot about stress and food. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the really interesting findings from the survey was when they compared the children who reported that they were overweight to the children who reported that they were normal weight. And the overweight children reported much more severe health conditions like difficulty falling asleep, headaches, upset stomach, and even eating too much or too little.
The survey showed that 40% of adults reported overeating or unhealthy eating because of stress. So it does appear that stress is a contributor to our obesity epidemic.
I do think that stress is a contributor to the obesity epidemic, but I also think that the relationship is circular, that when people are obese, they also tend to experience weight bias and discrimination, and that can in turn increase their feelings of stress. So unfortunately, the way people cope with stress sometimes exacerbates their obesity, which in turn makes the stress worse.
What happens to a child who's overweight in terms of the culture they live in, the feedback they get, what does that do to them?
Well, some people think that because childhood obesity has increased in prevalence, that there would be a decrease in bias and discrimination that children experience. But unfortunately, research has shown that that's not the case. So children who are overweight tend to get bullied. They tend to receive critical comments about their bodies, both from peers, but also, surprisingly, from parents or even health professionals who think that they're trying to be helpful by teasing the child or trying to encourage them to lose weight in sometimes a little bit of a biting manner.
You know, I was reading this survey, and you know, I thought about, you know, smoking, and we really as a culture helped cut that down, and part of the way we did was education, but in a way it was through shame of smoking, and that helped. But with eating, shame is going to make it worse, and I wonder. You know, the work Michelle Obama is doing is wonderful, and her heart's in the right place, but could that increase the shame associated with being overweight?
Well, it's really complicated, and at the Rudd Center, we study both the importance of having a healthy food environment, but also fighting obesity stigma, which sometimes sounds contradictory, but the way we see it is that obesity is not a behavior. Obesity is the result of behaviors, and for each person, the kind of relationship between their behaviors and their actual body weight is going to be different. But what we really focus on is the importance of healthy eating and being physically active for everyone, no matter what your body weight is. And I think if you frame it that way, then it really applies to the entire population, and you're not just singling out overweight children.
Let's eating aside or not just focusing on eating, can you tell us how children express their stress versus adults? What's the difference?
Well, some of the things children did were engage in sedentary activities like watching TV, playing on the computer, and things like that. And, of course, that also is not going to help them in terms of their body weight.
Hmm. It's in a way, it's counterintuitive to me that, you know, when you feel stress, you would want to discharge that energy rather than sitting and essentially doing nothing.
Yeah, it would be great if there were a way to help teach kids how to kind of get that energy out when they're feeling stressed, because usually people do feel better after they exercise, but it's getting that push to start exercising that is the hard part.
We're talking about stress today, something that's near and dear to everyone's heart. This show's based on the annual survey the American Psychological Association just came out with and reported some shocking levels of stress that the majority of people in this country are dealing with. We're talking with we've got three guests, or we'll have three guests. We're talking now with David Palmiter. He's a professor of psychology at Murraywood University in Scranton. He helped to develop the American Psychological Association survey that we were talking about, both this year and in the past. Marlene Schwartz is deputy director of the Rudd Center for Food and Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And in a little while, we'll be speaking with Dr. Michael Baim, a physician director of the University of Pennsylvania's Program for Mindfulness. Give us a call if you want to comment about stress, talk about your stress, what you can do about it, what you think some of the causes are. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'll be going to the phones after this break. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY. As the only accredited chest pain center in Chester County, they are committed to providing immediate comprehensive care for cardiac patients and to making lives better every day. Details at chestercountyhospital.org.
Two young girls from vastly different cultures find common ground in age-old miracles.
And a middle-aged man, adrift in a troubled and violent city, finds new hope in the hearts of those who love him. I'm Murray Horwitz.
And I'm Susan Stamberg. Hear those stories and more on the 2010 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Tomorrow night at 10 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY is brought to you by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about stress today, why it is rampant in our population with adults and children, and what we can do about it. It is so rampant that there are many in the mental health community that want to have this declared a public health hazard. My guests are Marlene Schwartz. She's deputy director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. David Palmiter is a professor of psychology at Marywood, and he helped develop the American Psychological Association survey. In a few minutes, we'll also hear from Dr. Michael Baim. He's director of the University of Pennsylvania's Program for Mindfulness. David, when Americans were asked in the survey what they do to manage stress, many answered with exercise, prayer, drinking, and shopping. So clearly some of these are healthy and some are not. Who's more likely to be in which category?
Well, I don't mean to, sound circular, but those who are doing well, are more likely to be in the category of adjusting in a healthy fashion to stress, and those who aren't doing well in the latter category. There's also something about, you have to remember that some folks, before life interacts with them, they have genetic vulnerabilities towards depression or anxiety or other behavioral disorders that can then influence how they interact with stress.
Marlene, the survey also found that a third of adults exercise less than once a week. And they say the main reason they don't take care of themselves is because they're not motivated or they're too tired. And I also read in a survey, lack of willpower is a big theme. But, you know, I wonder, is that a cause of stress also? Or that, are all those things symptomatic of stress?
Well, the fact that so many Americans blame themselves for not engaging in exercise or healthy eating and believing that it's a matter of willpower, I think in some ways people are being too hard on themselves, because many people live in an environment where it's actually very difficult to be physically active, and it's very difficult to have access to healthy food, to afford the healthier food. So I think that we need to take a closer look at the environment individuals live in, and it's possible that if you are in a low-income household and you don't have access to places to be physically active safely and access to healthy food, that that's going to both contribute to your stress and contribute to the challenge of engaging in those healthy behaviors.
What can be done?
Well, I think that trying to really change the environment, you mentioned Michelle Obama, I think her initiative is very much about looking at our entire country, finding places where people don't have access to healthier foods, trying to get grocery stores into those areas, cleaning up the corner stores and getting the fast food restaurants to offer healthier choices, getting schools to have healthy food there. All of those things are about making it easier for people to eat healthy so it doesn't take so much energy and sort of cognitive focus. It should be the default. It should be the easier option to engage in the healthy behaviors.
David, I'm interested in stress and gender. Women experience stress more so than men. Married women experience more stress than single women. How come?
Well, some of that, of course, is going to be due to women historically seem to be more likely to endorse these kinds of things than men are. But then also there's differences. Men tend to externalize more their psychological pain, and women more internalize. Of course, there's plenty of exceptions to that, but in terms of general trends. Specifically, too, in households where there's kids, there's a lot of single parenting going on in two-parent households, and that's most likely to fall on the woman. And then when you have single-parent households, they're more likely to be women as well, and women still make about 78 cents on the dollar compared to men. I also am struck by some of the career tensions that women feel. I mean, I train doctoral students. I've had a lot of students in my office grappling over whether they should have a child or go forward with their doctoral training, and not in one case has that student been a man. So I think there are some of those differences as well.
Michael, I want to bring you into the conversation. One of your reactions when we spoke to you about the survey, one of your reactions to the report said that kids are just trying to have a childhood and they're not able to do so. You had mentioned that when you were 13, you didn't spend 3 hours on homework. Neither did I. I mean, it's tough to imagine what life is like for them.
It really is, and all that I can say from my vantage point is that it sure looks different. That I remember spending hours lying on my back in the grass looking at the sky and imagining what those clouds might be, dragons or boats or airplanes or whatever, and my kids are too busy. The amount of homework that my 13-year-old brings into the house every night is really shocking, and the worst thing is that I'm getting to the point where I can't do the algebra, but
That's a different problem.
Yeah.
As an aside, we did a show on homework last year that showed there's some research that suggests kids should be getting 10 minutes of homework per night per grade. And that's not happening.
The fact that I know is that there really isn't good evidence to show that this homework provides a benefit in terms of learning, in terms of character, in terms of anything that has ever been measured.
Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Nancy on the line. Nancy, hi. You're on Voices.
Hi.
I'm
in a personal situation where I'm the guardian of my 8-year-old granddaughter, and she's having some learning issues. She's had a pretty traumatic life in her short 8 years, and we're having trouble sort of feeling out what the impact of the stress in her life so far, what part it's taken in her learning problems. And I was wondering if any of your guests could speak sort of specifically to that, or if they know of any specific programs dealing with kids and learning disabilities, or any information about that.
I would be happy to help you, but I need you to be more specific.
Okay.
So tell us about her. I don't want you to betray any confidences.
Right. Well, she has two parents that are both addicts. Her mother was out of her life at a certain point for like a year and a half. Her father ended up dying in a construction accident at age 30. She was relocated in the middle of that. She had an emergency appendectomy when she was in kindergarten. And so basically every year that she's attended school, kindergarten twice and first grade, there was some major upheaval in her life. And so now she's reading at a much lower level than she should be. She's in second grade currently at a very good private school, and she's getting a lot of support, but we're trying to figure out either other things we could do or ferret out, like, if she actually has learning disabilities or if all this major trauma and stress has been enough to keep her from, say, reading at grade level.
I can't imagine how we can sort out which is which and which causes what. To me, the question is, what can we do to best care for this girl? I wonder, David, do you want to weigh in?
I would say that there's an army of lean, mean healing machines spread across our country willing to help with things like this. Child psychologists are available to meet and do the kind of tailored evaluation that seems to be indicated here. Only about 20% of kids who could benefit from mental health services actually get it. What would we think about our country if the same was said about our children's dental pain? I mean, how primitive would we conceive of ourselves to be? Yet that's very much the case with our children and their mental health, even though mental health issues are often much more debilitating.
Well, let me be protective of Nancy's pocketbook here. I know it's pretty expensive to have a child get a good psychological workup from a private psychologist.
Often, not necessarily. So I actually have an article on my blog where I go into some other choices people might have. But off the top, if Nancy here lives in a community where there's graduate programs in the mental health professions, often there are training clinics available. I direct one up here in northeastern Pennsylvania where our average fee is about $10 a visit. There are community mental health centers. There are agencies that are supported by religious organizations. There are also private practitioners willing to work on a sliding scale or even pro bono basis if the circumstances call for it. I personally, Dan, I've not seen a case where someone didn't run out of persistence. They could not find effective quality care for their kid, regardless of financial concern. Now, maybe I'm living in a dream world, but I haven't seen a case of it.
Well, Nancy, so we're talking about a couple of things here.
Well, she does actually see a private therapist. We have good health insurance, and so that's in place. She goes weekly to work with a therapist. I guess what my issue is, or I guess what my bias is that, you know, she keeps getting older. Time keeps passing, whether we sort of figure out what her problem is or not. And I don't want her to keep getting further and further behind. So I just...
Well, let me ask Michael Boehm to weigh on it.
Okay.
Well, it does sound like the specifics of whatever is supporting or not supporting her learning are complicated, and that a detailed formal assessment would give you information that might help. But aside from that, which is, I think, straightforward, from where I sit right now, it seems to me that the most important thing for everything that happens to her moving forward is you. that you're actually holding her life in your hands, and just the fact that you called with this kind of caring tells me that she has something that has the possibility of undoing all of the suffering and difficulty that have happened up until now. So I think that if you really appreciate how important that is, and if you do everything that you can to take care of it and to support it, it will make a bigger difference than any learning intervention.
And Nancy, you know, one of the things I talked about in one of my books was that we know wounds to the skin heal at a rate of 1 millimeter a day. And you can't rush it. You can't make it go faster than 1 millimeter a day. And look at this child. You know, how deep are the wounds? How many wounds? And, you know, they're going to heal. They're going to heal in an environment that Michael just described, a holding, caring, loving environment. They will begin to heal. And it's going to happen on their own rate. And I would like to see her continue in therapy, and I would like to see her get this evaluation to see if there's more tailored, more specific treatments.
But she, right, as we speak practically, is being getting the cognitive tests. So
good.
We have all that support put in place, I guess, where I'm feeling is I feel like sending her to this private school is really a great thing for her because she's getting a lot of attention and she's getting all the support she needs and a lot of services. But on the other hand, this is more maybe a question about kids with learning disabilities.
Yeah.
I don't want to put her in a position to fail, I guess, is what I'm feeling like. Should I continue all this? It's sort of like your homework.
Well,
Nancy,
that's the stuff that hopefully will come out of the testing. I'm sorry we can't pursue this further. We are just out of time, and I do hope what we have talked about has been helpful. I wish you and your precious granddaughter the best. We've got to take a short break, and we've got to say goodbye to David and Marlene. Marlene Schwartz is Deputy Director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Marlene, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
David Palmiter is a professor of psychology at Marywood University. He helped develop the American Psychological Association's Stress in America survey. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
Take care. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Michael Bain more about stress, what we can do about it, what are some of the techniques, and how can we even begin to understand why it's so pervasive in this country. Well, our phone number is 888-477-9499. We have a couple of lines open, so please get your call in quickly. Again, that's 888-477-9499 if you want some help or advice in coping with stress. We've got one of the nation's leading experts here in our studio. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Heart Institute, where doctors perform a new life-saving procedure in post-cardiac arrest patients. The process, known as therapeutic hypothermia, lowers the body's temperature to 93 degrees and is instrumental in saving vital brain functions. Part of the Cooper Resuscitation Center, therapeutic hypothermia has been used to provide specialized care to cardiac arrest patients throughout South Jersey. For information on how Cooper is advancing medicine in South Jersey, cooperhealth.org/numbers or 800-8-COOPER.
Running for Congress isn't all kissing babies, eating corn dogs, and offering snappy answers in debate. It's also the down and dirty of scrapping for endorsements and raising and spending money, including your own. Lessons that losing candidate Bill Thomas learned in this year's midterm elections. Was it all worth it? Find out next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about stress in America. Well, stress in our lives, stress in our bodies, and stress in our families. We're joined by Dr. Michael Bain. He's a physician director of the University of Pennsylvania's Program for Mindfulness. And our number, if you want to call in, get some share some thoughts about stress in your life or get some ideas about how to cope with your stress, our number is 888-477-9499. Michael, many people cite many reasons for their stress, but we had a guest on our show fairly recently who said the major cause of our stress is the voices inside our heads.
I wonder how many of them he has.
But, you know, is it true? Is it not literally the voices inside our heads, but, you know, the way we judge ourselves,
sure.
The way we assess our lives?
Sure. It's hard to have a mind sometimes. It's as if we're our own worst critic, and we know just how to give ourselves a hard time. So the way that we think about what will happen in the future and sort of plan for it becomes catastrophizing, that we think about what a disaster it will be, and then we have to live that horrible prediction for the future over and over again, even though it's ridiculous, it'll never happen, and it's not even helpful to rehearse it that way. But we do that.
It's like Mark Twain's line, where he said, I've lived through 1,000 catastrophes in my life, and a few of them have actually happened. But, you know, Michael, it's easy to say, don't do that. You know, it's easy to say, well, that's in the future, and we don't know about the future. But, you know, how do you do that?
Yeah, and the reason that we can't do that is that, in a way, we don't even notice that it's happening. So that when we catastrophize, when we have these awful thoughts about the future, or for that matter, when we dredge up the worst things that have happened in the past and sort of relive them over and over again, we're doing that on kind of an automatic pilot, so that we aren't even aware that we've left our real life and are playing out some kind of imaginary past or future.
We do that even when the thoughts inside our head get too loud. I used to commute to work, and I would stop on my way, and, you know, as I used to stop at a park on my way to meditate in the morning. And I remember sitting at the park meditating, listening to the sounds of the geese. And during my practice, of course, I got lost in my thoughts, like all humans do, and I realized that, oh, damn, I'm supposed to be meditating here. So, you know, I come back to my breath, I like wake up to my life, and there's the sound of the geese again. I literally didn't hear the geese when I was thinking so loud.
Oh, totally. You can completely leave your actual life. You can leave your body and your mind even, and sort of play some kind of old tape loop that just goes over and over and over again. And even if you get upset, it's as if you're having the visceral sensations as if it were really happening. So you've created your own little bubble of reality there. And you can't tell that it's not real until you notice that it's happening.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Stephanie on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, I think that by focusing so much on our stress levels, we stop asking ourselves the questions that are really important, like, not how stressed am I, but what am I grateful for? What's the difference between what I need and what I want? What am I afraid of right now? I think when I ask myself those questions, I'm able to bring myself back a little bit to reality. And I find that my perspective on my life changes greatly.
Well, Michael, you know, what I hear Stephanie saying is that, you know, there's lots of ways of waking up and getting out of your head besides meditating, sitting on a cushion.
Oh, totally. And, you know, Stephanie, I'm guessing that you're in those 25% of people who are not feeling that their life is uncomfortably stressful, not over the 3.7 on the life stress scale that we heard about. So the question is, though, when you don't feel that way, when things aren't going that well, when you're fearful or anxious or sad, how do you get back to that way of feeling and thinking that you described?
My first indication that I'm heading that way is that I start feeling agitated. And when I recognize agitation in myself, my first thought is, oh, stop. What are you grateful for? And that's where I begin.
Well, with all due respect, it sounds like you begin a little bit before that, because there's something inside you that wakes up to the fact that you're feeling distress.
Well, but beginning to realize what that what agitation is has taken me years. I consider that a piece of what growing up is. It's also for me a matter of asking myself, what information am I choosing to take in about the world? Am I getting my information all of a sudden from a media source that's telling me that there's a crisis because it's raining? Or, you know, how am I judging what information about the world I need to be paying attention to right now?
That's interesting. That's interesting. Well, thanks so much for your call, and thanks for your insight. I think that's really helpful. Michael, you know, we did a show, we just repeated it a couple of weeks ago on gratitude. And you know, keeping a gratitude journal, there's lots of research on gratitude, really does change figure and ground. It changes what we're looking at, what we choose to attend to. And, you know, a lot of what you teach in mindfulness meditation is really about attention. Yes?
Absolutely. And as Stephanie was talking about what she does and how it works, when you asked her to go back to the first thing that happens, I was hearing her describe mindfulness, which doesn't necessarily involve sitting on a cushion or doing meditation or really doing anything at all except noticing what's happening right in that moment. So Stephanie noticed that she was having these feelings, and to her, those feelings signify some sort of another process that's affecting her. And just by noticing that, she can make an active choice to redirect what she's thinking about and really where she goes with that, what it means to her.
Or not.
Or not, if that would be what's best. Maybe, in fact, she's noticing something that is a true threat. Maybe she really should be worried, and maybe she has to deal with that. Yeah. But she'll make an intelligent choice instead of just running that same old tape loop on automatic pilot over and over again.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Heather on the line. Hi, Heather.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I guess my question kind of comes in where the last caller left off. I actually also try and spend a good bit of my time thinking about what I'm grateful for, and in my own life with my daughters, when we go to bed, we try and do that as well, implement this ritual of what are we thankful for today. And I find that that does, it really helps your perspective. But even with all of that, I get a lot of physiological responses to my stress where it impacts my health. And I've had several people suggest to me, oh, you should try meditation. And I've, you know, tried to do that clear the monkey mind or whatever it's called. And I just don't seem to be able to have any kind of positive impact in attempting to do that sort of thing. I think the gratitude and sort of reframing your perspective has helped me a lot in my own personal life. But my question is, when you're having these physiological stress responses in the moment, I seriously feel sometimes like I'm going to have a brain aneurysm if I don't, like, you know, just take a minute and get it under control, when you're out driving and things like that, or something is going on with a interpersonal relationship. So my question is, having had some weird undiagnosable health issues that I personally feel in my heart come from an inability to manage my stress in a positive way, does your guest have any suggestions on a starting point?
Yeah, let's talk to Michael and see what he has to say about that. And by the way, Heather, you were concerned about not being able to calm your monkey mind. I have been a devout meditator for about 12 years now, and at the end of 12 years, I'm pleased to report that my monkey mind is alive and healthy and happy as it's ever been. So, Michael, what do you have to say for?
Well, I'm going to say, Heather, that you're right and you're right, and I'll tell you what I mean. You're right, first of all, that when your body gets into the act, no amount of psychological strategizing is going to change that. It's your body reacts to stress as a threat. And basically, if you get down to the very bottom line of all stress, it's really something that some part of us finds threatening. It might be self-esteem or social standing or finances, and it might be life or death, but it's a threat one way or another. And once that physical reactivity gets activated, hormones get released, muscular things happen, all sorts of real physical things happen, and they don't just go away because you do something with your mind. The hormones have to be metabolized and spent. The muscles that have tensed take a little bit of time to relax. It's not just going to go away because you apply some antidote. So a little bit of patience and some acceptance of the fact that, yeah, I do get really bent out of shape sometimes. Sometimes this is really hard. And allowing it to be as it is can be very helpful. And then the second thing that I would say, the other way in which you're right, is that, as Dan pointed out, you're not going to stop your mind from jumping around. Your mind is doing what it's supposed to do, which is planning, anticipating, trying to come up with strategies that will help you and protect you. It's a good thing to have a mind. But there's another part of you, the part of you that I guess we could just call your awareness, which is the part of you that's noticing that mind. So in a way, there's a part of you that's separate from all of the jumping about up and down, the monkey mind that you and Dan talked about. And that part of you is reliable, is always available, and is very steady. It's dependable. And so when you practice mindfulness or when you just notice what's happening, it's that part of you that you're calling upon. And all that these mindfulness practices do is that they help you to connect with that more easily. But they're not going to make your mind stop doing anything, just like they're not going to make your heart slow down when it started to beat more quickly. They're going to help you notice and come back to your own natural sense of balance.
Heather, I hope that was helpful. Michael, I want to talk about something we talked about in the first segment of the show, and that's children and stress. And, you know, you alluded to it, you're concerned about children. We're not going to get children to sit on a cushion and close their eyes and say, "Om." What can we do to help our kids?
Well, you know, maybe we are going to get our children to do that, actually, although not quite in the way that you described, because the whole approach that we've been talking about, mindfulness, has become really quite a hot topic in education. And in fact, schools are building the health, wellness, and resiliency part of their curriculum around that principle. But it looks very different when a kid would practice it. It would be much more physical and active.
Like what?
Well, instead of sitting down and following your breath, for instance, which would be a traditional mindfulness meditation practice, you would have them take three steps and count them. One, two, three, and then stop and focus all of their attention on one breath. Or they might do something that looks more like yoga than meditation.
So what's the value of that, taking three steps and focusing on one breath?
Because kids are not just like little people. But in the way in which they can get lost from themselves and in the way in which these patterns and habits get activated and the way in which there's some biology there, they're just like us. And if you can get them to come back into what's happening right now, they're less reactive, they're more settled, and they definitely make better choices.
I read a research article that suggested that people who took 15-minute walks in nature twice a day who had ADD, those walks in slow walks in nature had as much impact as medication did.
Yep. There are all sorts of things that you can do with your mind. It's not as if it's really separate from the body, but the two really work together. And it's such an exciting field because we don't know all the ways in which those principles can be applied, but that sounds like one.
And one of the things you are talking about, and meditation experts and researchers, is that we are learning that we are not our minds. Our minds are a part of us.
Right, or it's as if the part of you that thinks and the emotions that you have and the sensations are something that you experience with a different part of what you are, your awareness, or the part of you that notices. And we know really where that is located in the brain, or we can identify the brain regions, the neural areas that are associated with noticing. And it looks like all of these different practices, and lots of psychotherapeutic practices too, activate those regions.
We've only got a few seconds left. You've been doing this for a lot of years now. Have you noticed any change in the people who take your 8-week course?
Oh, that's so interesting. Totally. I mean, when we began, it's been almost 20 years now. It has been 20 years now. We were based in a hospital, and we were referred patients, mostly by other physicians, who were in one way or another, quote, hopeless. They had cancer, chronic pain, whatever. And now most of our clients are white-collar professional, very well-educated, and they're looking for something completely different.
Yeah, and your classes are filling up, and you've got many of them, and more people are looking for this venue for stress management. Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. You're very welcome. Thank you.
My guest has been Michael Boehm. He's the director of the University of Pennsylvania's Program for Mindfulness. Earlier in the show, we heard from David Palmiter, who's a professor of psychology at Marywood University. He helped craft the APA's annual Stress in America survey. We also heard from Marlene Schwartz, deputy director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Well, if you want to reach us, we'd love to hear from you. We're at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer on today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Maggie Zahn and Stephanie Pena are our interns. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friend.
Tell me more.